be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Revert v. Dorner.
May it please the court, Mr. J. Neal will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. We're here today to determine whether or not to allow an appeal to go forward. The cost bond is filed one day late. No extension of time request is filed. The Court of Appeals, in its original opinion, has since been withdrawn, said that the late filing was reasonably explained as a matter of law. However, they thereafter reversed themselves, holding the requirements of Appellate Rule 41A2 to be jurisdictional. First of all, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present this issue to the court, but it comes with great regret because this is a case of lawyer error, and I am that lawyer. Should this cause a dismissal of my client's case? No, it should not. It's important for this court to have an understanding, since we're here on a procedural defect, about what the issue was to be before the Court of Appeals. This is a case that was brought on behalf of three minor children by their father, John Berber. The defendant, Patricia Dorner, had obtained records, confidential records, from the Methodist Mission Home regarding the minor plaintiff's mother previously placing a child for adoption numerous years before she had married their father and had given birth to them. Methodist Mission Home had allowed Patricia Dorner access to these confidential records, and the mother was tracked down and found and reunited with a child of 16 years, a daughter who had been placed for adoption, who herself had just placed a child for adoption and was an emotional wreck, according to the testimony of the counsel.
Counsel, we're called upon to make this decision.
Yes, so you are.
Wholly apart from the merits of the underlying case.
Understand, Your Honor, but whether or not a case is heard and why a case should be heard is relevant to whether or not this particular client has made a bona fide attempt to invoke the jurisdiction of the appellate court. The question that was before the trial court was whether or not a duty was owed by the counselor to provide counseling to the family members, and whether or not a cause of action existed that this court has previously held did not exist in favor of spouses against one another, that is, negligent interference with familial relationships. This court has never addressed the underlying issue about whether or not 3.62 of the Family Code precludes a child's cause of action or a similar cause of action to alienation of affection. The summary judgment stated there was no cause of action and there was no extreme and outrageous conduct based upon no duty. The summary judgment was signed on October 10th of 1995. Under Rule 41, Texas Rules of Civil Appellate Procedure, the bond was due to be filed on November 9th, 1995. November 10th of 1995 was a holiday, Veterans Day, recognized by the San Antonio Commissioner's Court. The following day was a Saturday. The following day was a Sunday. The first day thereafter, on Monday, November 13th, 1995, the cost bond on appeal was filed. A bona fide attempt was made to invoke the jurisdiction of the appellate court by following that cost bond. However, inadvertently, the lawyer, I am that lawyer, made a miscalculation as to the date. That was the 34th day after the signing of the judgment. The cost bond was due with a motion to extend time on the 24th of November of 1995, recognizing that Justice Chapa for the Fourth Court of Appeals, under the authority given him under Rule 83 of the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure, issued a show cause order requesting of myself why it is that the appeal should not be dismissed for failure to make a bona fide attempt to invoke the jurisdiction of his court. Initially, the Court of Appeals retained the case on the docket until the Court of Criminal Appeals came out, which seemed to indicate that Rule 41A2 was jurisdictional, at least in the Court of Criminal Appeals' mind. Rule 83 provides that a judgment shall not be affirmed, reversed, or an appeal dismissed for defects or irregularities in appellate procedure. Gentlemen and Justice Spector, Justice Owen, we have a defect in a procedural. We do not have.
I heard you say there was a show cause order issued, yes. And then what was the response to that?
And the response to the show cause order, Your Honor, was the error of a lawyer, and I am that lawyer. And that error was, that occurred on the 284th day of the year, the signing of the order. I added 30 days to that and came up with the 314th day of the year. That 314th day of the year, the court can obviously did not include the last day of the filing. And therefore, the date that I had circled on my calendar was November 10th, 1995, a court holiday.
But this was communicated to the court.
It was communicated. And that, in their response, an opinion written initially by Justice Green, joined by Justice Chaffee and the justice who filed a dissent, Sarah Duncan, they determined that that was, as a matter of law, a reasonable explanation, and they drew on
so
for
this,
that.
This was an opinion that was
later
prior
withdrawn.
No, but prior to the consideration of the substance of the case.
Prior to the consideration
this
of the
this was just
case.
On the issue of whether it was jurisdictional.
Yes. And in fact, they relied on the Garcia versus Kastner Farms case, which says any conduct short of deliberate or intentional noncompliance qualifies as inadvertent mistake or mischance, even if that conduct can also be characterized as professional negligence.
Mr. Neal, was the reason explaining the lateness filed within 15 days of the day that it was due?
No, Your Honor, because we did not at that time know that it was late. And it's our position that the Fourth Court of Appeals took the proper approach at that time. They took the approach under the inclusionary view of Rule 83, not the later exclusionary view of 41A2 that they took. The inclusionary rule of 83 allows a court on a case-by-case basis when determining this to then make that valid determination whether or not a party made a bona fide attempt to invoke the court's jurisdiction. The court has stated that again and again in Maxfield and in as well as Linwood versus NCNB. This appellate process in the state of Texas is supposed to be a process of inclusion, not of exclusion.
So Rule 41D2, which says that the reason explaining the need for the extension must be filed, the motion with the reason for the extension must be filed within 15 days is just advisory.
No.
If at any point in the process a motion with a reason to explain comes in, then that would be a basis for the court, for the appellate court to have jurisdiction for the appeal.
I characterize it as two ways. I do a fair amount of appellate work, and I've appeared before this court before. I have never in my practice seen a motion for extension of time to file a bond within that 15-day period of time be denied. And I think that that's what that rule basically says. If you do it, you're in. But in the event, and I think it was aptly pointed out in the opinion by the court, when they stated what their issue was, it's what happens when a litigant, believing in good faith that he has filed that instrument timely, thus satisfying his own basis for, we don't have to file a motion for extension of time. What happens in that fact situation? And I think that is a fact situation covered by Maxfield. Let's review what happened in Maxfield. In Maxfield, we got a probate proceeding initiated to issue letters of testamentary. A separate cause number within the same case is set up to determine whether or not a summary judgment should be issued confirming a decision of a prior state. Both orders were sought to be appealed. Both orders were sought to be appealed. Two separate cause numbers. In Maxfield, they didn't file a bond in both cause numbers. They filed a bond in just one cause number. And in fact, talking about prejudice, the other side, Terry, didn't even know Maxfield was complaining of the summary judgment order until he gets the brief in the mail. But at that point, it says that the Supreme Court said, this group says that the Court of Appeals should have given the appellant an opportunity to create the defect before dismissing the appeal, the inclusionary provisions of Rule 83.
But the bond that was in question, that there was a bond that was filed within the 30 days.
Wrong case. Wrong. There was nothing filed in the summary judgment case. Not a word. And also in the case of...
So what is it? What is the bona fide attempt? If what is the bona fide attempt to invoke the jurisdiction of the court that occurred in that case that permitted the court then to allow the defect to be checked?
The court said that they should have been given the opportunity to correct their defects.
What was the defect that was
the defect was there was nothing filed in the summary judgment case. The defect was that they had filed a brief on a case that they had not properly appealed.
If they had not filed the bond in the wrong numbered case within the 30 days, would that have even been an issue? Would there have ever even been a defect?
No, sir. And I think that the court looked and saw that they had made a bona fide attempt to appeal from this. Just like the Linwood case. In the Linwood case, the wrong document was filed. And we're of the opinion in the case at bar the wrong document was filed. In Linwood, a notice of appeal was filed prior to the running of the 30 days. No cost bond. They had also asked for a request for finding facts and conclusions of law. It's a summary judgment. 53 days after the judgment had been signed, the conclusions of facts and request was ineffective to extend the compensation. 53 days later, the cost bond was filed on appeal. This court held in a per curiam opinion that the Court of Appeals has jurisdiction over an appeal if a party files an instrument in a bona fide attempt to invoke the appellate court's jurisdiction.
If nothing had been filed in this case until 45 days after the date of the judgment, would that have been a bona fide
I think under that set of circumstances, Justice, that the Court of Appeals is in has to determine whether that's a bona fide attempt. And I think a bona fide attempt is based upon a good faith attempt. And as the Court of Appeals held as a matter of law in its first opinion, we've made a good faith attempt to file that on time. And we had a reasonable explanation for failing to do it. And I think that that is what allows the appellate court the opportunity to determine whether or not a bona fide attempt has been made. But the fourth court then inadvertently got sidetracked by the Court of Criminal Appeals saying that 41A or 41B2 is jurisdiction. I think the jurisdiction part has been reached in the other cases where they say jurisdiction is conferred upon a bona fide attempt to invoke that jurisdiction. And that bona fide attempt has been made. The bond was filed. It was a good faith belief that it was timely filed. Show cause response was made. The show cause response was made with a supplemental record showing that the date that was thought to be the date the bond was due was a court holiday. A brief was filed in this case. It filed timely. But the wrong document was all that was filed. In this case, there should have been two documents filed on that 34th day. A motion to extend time to file the bond and the bond. We filed the wrong document. Identical to Linwood, analogous to Linwood. I wish I could sit here and tell you this is a case of first impression, but I think that Maxfield, I think that Jamar, and I think that Linwood have already dealt with this issue. And I think that issue is based upon a good faith attempt to invoke the jurisdiction. Under Rule 83 and Rule 83, you're given an opportunity to correct the defects. The defect in this case was there was no reasonable showing or request for an extension of time. That's the defect. None of these parties were harmed. Heard the deal on Sports Center this morning, now I know where it comes from. No harm, no foul was created by Chick Hearn, announcer for the Los Angeles Lakers. I found that out this morning. That describes this situation. These parties knew that an appeal was filed. They were not harmed by this appeal, and they weren't harmed by the court initially retaining it upon the docket. 41 is jurisdictional to the extent that something must be filed. This court has even said that 41 is not jurisdictional if a bond is not filed. Because in the Linwood case, a notice of appeal was filed, not a bond. In the Jamar case, this court even said that a motion for new trial that was not completed by the paying of the fee could be conditionally filed. This court has been under the direct statement that these rules are to be interpreted liberally to include, not to exclude, based upon procedural irregularities.
Any other questions? Thank you, Chairman. The court is ready to hear arguments from respondents.
May it please the court. Mr. Edward Mines and Mr. Stephen Dahlman will present argument for the respondent. Mr. Mines will open with the first 15 minutes.
May it please the court. Petitioner's argument would have Rule 41 read thus: an appeal is perfected if and when a bona fide attempt or an instrument is filed in a bona fide attempt to invoke appellate jurisdiction after the appellant has been given a reasonable time within which to correct defects, as subsequently determined by a court in retrospect on an ad hoc basis. What's wrong with that? The petitioner's argument reads the 30-day time limit of perfecting an appeal out of Rule 41.
How is that?
Pardon me?
How is that?
Nothing was filed within 30 days. There was no motion, and I'm speaking in the context of this record and the facts here. There was no post, there was no motion for new trial, no post-judgment motion. The original timeline for perfecting an appeal was 30 days. Nothing whatever was filed within 30 days. The bond was not one day late, it was 4 days late. It was filed on the 34th day. Nothing was filed within 45 days of judgment beyond that. The transcript was ultimately filed in the Court of Appeals in early December. On December 21, in a jurisdictional screening, the Court of Appeals issued a show cause order. The response to that was not filed until January 22, and the response was not verified. It was not in the form of a motion for extension. In fact, the response indicated that no motion for extension had been timely filed. What's in the Court of Appeals, in its original opinion that was withdrawn, stated that that response in January, which was after the 45 days, constituted a reasonable explanation, but that explanation went outside the record. It was based, at first, all that was made in the response was argument, and it was not verified. There was no affidavit. If you look at the Smurl opinion, which is cited in the briefs and cited in the dissenting opinion, as well as Glidden versus Aetna, when jurisdictional facts are not in the record and the Court of Appeals needs those facts, they have to be presented in the form of an affidavit or other evidence. The response didn't provide that. Never did. There was never any reasonable explanation made in the Court of Appeals for the late filing. What's wrong with no compliance with 41 in 30 days, no compliance within 45 days, the 15-day grace period? It reads the 30-day time limit out. It reads the 15-day grace period out of the rule.
How does it read the 30-day time limit out if you still have to show good cause?
That was not done.
It may not have been done. But if you still had to do it, how would it read the 30 days out?
Well, it was saying it's not applicable here because we can go beyond that. And in fact, the way Rule 41 reads in the civil appeals portion, it says that the bond has to be filed in the trial court, and the motion offering the reasonable explanation in the Court of Appeals not later than 15 days after the last day, which is the 45th day. And if you attempt to use Rule 83 and the reasonable time to correct or amend defects of 83, there's a conflict then between 83, reasonable time going out to January 22 on this record and on these facts, when the 45th day was November 27, the 45 days. The petitioner's argument provides no certainty, no definitiveness, no predictability, no finality to a trial court judgment.
Why isn't it pretty predictable that if you don't file a cost bond within 30 days and don't have a good reason for doing it, and file something within 45 days, you're going to lose? Why isn't that fairly predictable?
That is predictable. That's our position. They didn't.
Well, for example, why shouldn't the Court of Appeals have treated cost bond as implying the motion? What other reason is there to file it within 45 days?
A number of reasons. One is the rules require a written motion. It can't be implied. The local rules of the Fourth Court required a verified motion to establish facts that aren't in the record. The misunderstanding of the law, if that's what it was. The Smurl case requires that. The Glidden case requires that.
If this had been called motion and bill of and cost bond and the rest of the text had been the same, would that have been good enough?
No. The bond is filed in the trial court. The motion for an extension is filed in the appellate court.
So if it's filed in the wrong court, that's bad too?
Yes. But I think this question is addressed, and the thrust of petitioner's argument is that you can use Rule 83 to provide a time to cure. Well, if you look back at the origin and the derivation of the rules, and I want to cite a case that's not in the briefs, it's Walker versus Clear, 174 Southwest 2nd, 956. That was written by Chief Justice Alexander in 1943, shortly after the rules were originally adopted. The rules of civil procedure were first adopted in October of 40. They were amended twice in 41, March and December of 41. At that time, Chief Justice Alexander was a professor at Baylor on practice and procedure, was on the Waco Court of Appeals. He taught clinics on the new rules. Shortly after, the new rules went into effect, and the predecessor rule to 83 was Rule 437. And if you look at the commentary under 437 in the hardbound book of rules, there's a cite to a Texas Bar Journal article by Robert Story of Austin on an analysis of the rules shortly after they were written and adopted. He says that the court then made plain that the time limits for perfecting an appeal were never subject to Rule 437. 437 is 83 today. So from inception and historically, you could never invoke Rule 83 to cure a jurisdictional defect. Now back to Walker versus Clear and Alexander's opinion in 43. And that was an appeal from an interlocutory venue judgment denying the defendant's plea of privilege. Under the rules then, you had to do two things to perfect an appeal. You had to file a bond within 20 days, and within the same time frame, 20 days, you had to file the record in the appellate court. In fact, the rule had a 20-day, or filing the record, had a 20-day proviso and a 5-day grace period. It also provided for a motion for extension back then for good cause, not reasonable explanation. In that case, the bond was timely filed. The record was not. There was no motion for extension of time. And Chief Justice Alexander, in answering a certified question for this court, for a unanimous court, said there's no jurisdiction. That when there are two steps required to perfect an appeal, the taking of only one of those steps is insufficient. And if you look at the parallel between that rule with its original time limit of 20 days and the 5-day grace period and the motion for extension back then, it parallels Rule 41 today. That opinion also discussed Rules 404 and 405, which today are Rules 71 and 72, dealing with informalities in the record. Justice Alexander said those jurisdictional requirements can't be waived. He was making a distinction. Those are jurisdictional defects. They're not procedural irregularities within what was then 437 and what is now 83. If you look to the Court of Criminal Appeals opinion on this very question in Olivo versus State, and that's cited in the briefs, the Court of Criminal Appeals last year addressed this very question. And in that case, a notice of appeal, a motion for extension for the late filing had not been filed. The Court of Criminal Appeals construing very similar language, held that the two requirements are jurisdictional, and without them, there's no jurisdiction. The timely filing of a notice of appeal in the criminal case, and the timely filing of a motion for extension if you don't file it within the original 30-day time frame. I realize that that opinion is not binding on this court. But when the integrated rules of appellate procedure were adopted in 86, the charge from this court and from the Court of Criminal Appeals was to harmonize the rules in civil and criminal appeals so that there won't be any differences unless there is a substantial requirement or reason for the differences. Justice Clarence Guattari spoke to that in harmonizing the rules in 48 Texas Bar Journal 24. Both before and after the adoption of the appellate rules in 1986, there have been a host of cases which hold that the time requirements for perfecting an appeal are jurisdictional. They can't be waived, they're not subject to agreement, and they can't be cured. That's the Walker versus Clear, the Glidden versus Aetna, and there are any number of civil appeals opinions. After,
I guess you agree, though, that if a cost bond had been timely filed in this case within 30 days, but it had the wrong number on it, wrong case number on it, it would have perfected the fee.
Yes.
How does that make sense? If you don't even know the case, the right case that's being filed in, that perfects appeal. But if you do know the right case, but it's filed within 15 days, it doesn't.
Well, you've timely filed an instrument, and you've invoked the jurisdiction of the court. In this case, within 30 days, nothing was filed. And the bond was filed on the 34th day within the 15-day grace period, but that doesn't get you home. There's a second step to invoking appellate jurisdiction there. That's the motion reasonably explaining the late filing, and that motion has to be granted. Here, there was never any such motion. There was no order of the Court of Appeals granting the motion. There was no reasonable explanation made on verified facts to the Court of Appeals.
I guess you also agree that if a document had been filed within 30 days but was not a cost bond, just a sentence, I want to appeal, that would have perfected.
Well, Linwood, Grand Prairie, where a notice of appeal, the wrong instrument was filed, this court has said that, and in all of those cases, there was a perfecting instrument of some kind filed within the 30-day timeline. And that invoked appellate jurisdiction, allowing a time for correction. Here, that was not done. There was no reasonable explanation ever made and no order of the Court of Appeals ever granting leave to late file the bond. Petitioner cites two cases.
I thought there was an interlocutory. You said there was no order. I thought there was an interlocutory opinion.
It was withdrawn.
But there was one at one time.
There was one in March, which was subsequently withdrawn and vacated.
Right.
In an en banc opinion, were they dismissed because appellate jurisdiction had not been timely and properly invoked. If you look, there are two law review articles after the adoption of the appellate rules in 86, 20 St. Mary's Law Journal 1 by Timothy Patton on deadlines and extension motions in civil appellate matters, and a 50 Texas Bar Journal, 642, written by a briefing attorney and a staff attorney from the Houston Court First and 14th on the nuts and bolts of civil appellate practice. In both of those, they come to the conclusion that under the new appellate rules, the 15-day timeline, the grace period, is absolute. Beyond that, there is no discretion, no discretion vested in the Court of Appeals to grant the late filing of a bond. And that's the way it should be. The litigants, the bar, the attorneys, the public need to know when a judgment becomes final. And if you look at 41, the way it's written now and the way it's proposed to be carried into the new rules effective this September, they still carry forward the 30-day, again, assuming no post-judgment motions, and the 15-day grace period. What does that give you? It gives you some reasonable, predictable timelines, which are essential to appellate jurisdiction, essential to definitiveness, essential to certainty. It also gives you a forgiveness factor. It gives you the 30 days. It gives you the 15-day motion for extension.
If on the 34th day no bond had been filed but a motion for extension of time, would that have invoked the court's jurisdiction?
No. I think you have to comply with both. I think Chief Justice Alexander answered that in the Walker versus Clear case. Now, when two steps are required to perfect, doing one only is not sufficient. You have to do both.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm Stephen Naum, and I rise to speak for the Methodist Mission Home, which is a licensed adoption agency and a charitable institution in San Antonio. I am here to speak not to the facts of the matter, we don't have the time, but I'm here to speak to one matter mentioned by counsel for Ms. Dorner, and that is, when is the trial court judgment in Texas final? And we ask you that whatever opinion you write in this case, if you indeed choose to write an opinion, you must answer that question. You must tell us at what time and after what events can we tell our respective clients that the litigation is over. In other words, finality of trial court judgment. Now, we all know lawsuits determine important rights. Who owns Blackacre? Was the defendant's conduct below the standard of care? Who gets Grandpa's ranch and who gets his oil wells? All those things require firm and fixed determinations. Once the trial court makes that determination, the question is that final? And that's where Rule 41 comes into play.
If no bond or if no cash bond is filed within 30 days, but just any document is filed in 30 days, do you agree that any document perfects an appellate jurisdiction in any particular case?
Anything that looks like a bona fide attempt to invoke that jurisdiction would preserve jurisdiction.
So whatever is filed has to at least appear to be an attempt to invoke the jurisdiction.
Your Honor, even if a person appeared who had filed a cost bond on a cocktail napkin from the men's club in Houston, if they had done that, that would be sufficient under the bona fide attempt rule to invoke appellate jurisdiction. This court has held that anything that looks like it would do so would be sufficient.
So why isn't a bond that's filed after the 30 days but in the 15-day period, why isn't that just any old document that looks like an extension of time be sought?
Because finality of judgment requires arbitrary time limits. 41A sets a 30-day limit. You don't file within that time, the consequences are described to you by Glidden, they are described to you by Walker, and described to you by Davies. You do not have jurisdiction. The Court of Appeals can do nothing but dismiss.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
As the Court of Appeals determined, and they state it this way, we are confronted with the question whether the appellate rules condone a result that allows a litigant who knows he is late with his bond to save his appeal, but rejects the appeal of the litigant who erroneously, but in good faith, believes he has timely filed his bond, and thus satisfied, also believe he has no need to file for an extension of time. Key word is bona fide attempt to invoke the court's jurisdiction. That is a good faith belief that you have done so. Justice Duncan says it best in her dissent, and I can't say it any better, so I'm going to read it. The flaw in the majority, that's the Fourth Court's analysis, and its disregard of not only Rule 83 but also Rule 2 arises out of its initial characterization of the issue as whether the appellate rules condone a patently unfair result. By phrasing the issue in this manner, the majority presumes that a patently unfair result must obtain unless a rule or Supreme Court opinion precludes it. Finding no such authority, the majority concludes that the rules condone the patently unfair result it reaches. But the majority's presumption rests upon an approach to the rule that has been repeatedly rejected by this court. The correct approach rests upon the opposite presumption, that the issue is not whether the rules condone a patently unfair result, but whether or not they require it. The correct presumption has been most eloquently and succinctly stated by one of the original drafters of the rule, Chief Justice Alexander, just quoted to you by the attorneys for the respondent. The object of the new rules, and this is written in 1945, is to obtain a just, fair, equitable, and impartial adjudication of the rights of the litigants. A bona fide attempt was made. Respondents are trying to tell you that nothing done after 30 days can be a bona fide attempt to invoke the appellate court's jurisdiction. Nothing after 30 days can be done. Wrong instrument or not, you can file a cocktail napkin from a strip bar in Houston, is what they just told you, as long as you do it within 30 days. But if you're one day late, and even though you tried to invoke the jurisdiction, and even though Maxfield's out there, where nothing was done until the brief was filed 9 months, or the Linwood case, where the wrong document was filed, or in a situation where the case out of the valley, and I can't recall the site, where it was filed in the wrong cause number.
Mr. Neal, let me ask you, the bona fide attempt to file a cocktail napkin filed within 30 days, you look at it, does it express some sort of intent on the part of the parties to appeal a judgment?
I mean, that's no more than a cost bond, Your Honor.
Then, if you accept that a second step is required in the 15-day period, I mean, if only a filing appeal bond during 45 days is required, there'd be no purpose to the rule. So the rule says something else has to happen in this 15-day period, and something else that has to happen has to be a motion for extension of time, reasonably explaining why the bond wouldn't buy. Can a document that is obviously a cost bond, as a matter of law, evidence an intent to request a motion to extend time to satisfy the second obligation, which is a bona fide attempt to file a motion for extension of time?
Well, I'm not sure that this court requires a bona fide attempt to file a motion for extension of time. I think
if that's not the case, then wouldn't just you file your cost bond at any time in 45 days, then all that's left is you tell the court, I forgot, I miscounted, and you've perfected the appeal to the Court of Appeals.
I think it goes to the question, Justice Enoch, of whether or not there's good faith belief that you have done something to invoke that jurisdiction. A bona fide attempt. You can't file a document on the 45th day and say you can't count to 30. Now, I mean, I filed it on the 34th day and said I can't count to 30, but there's a little bit different, and that's what it goes as to whether or not somebody showed a bona fide attempt, a good faith attempt, something that they did that shows to everybody that they're unsatisfied with the judgment and they want to be heard by an appellate court on the substance and not procedural irregularities.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thanks.
That concludes the arguments for today. These arguments will be submitted. These cases will be submitted to court on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands.